These times it is necessary for us to
rather carefully evaluate the circumstances of the day
and also to try to understand as thoroughly as we can the factors that contribute to the essential progress of mankind. The great journey of man is a long one. Its beginnings we know very little about. And in the narrow band covered by history, we observe the struggle of the human being through various emergencies which he has created largely for himself, partly by ignorance and partly by the misuse and abuse of what he likes to call knowledge, which perhaps is only another name for ignorance. For if we abuse, we are ignorant. We also realize that at almost any point in man's career, he might have come to a hopeless blocking of his progress, had not crisis arisen. Now we look back over the pages of history again, and we find almost constant record of crisis. Various nations in various degrees of cultural development have come again and again to those critical periods in which it seemed for a moment that their national destinies were lost. In these critical moments, violent, often vicious circumstances arose. And in due time, there also rose a remedy against the immediate evil. The individual found some strange providence that seemed to guide him out of emergency and into a new line of endeavor, a little closer to reality. And after a while, he wandered again. Again, nature moved against him. We determined that he should not be permitted to escape from the boundaries of survival and to place himself in a situation beyond recall. We observe this, and we are aware that these critical periods are seldom pleasant. But there is some consolation in the fact that most of them have been well deserved, and that out of them, humanity as a stream of life has emerged, chastened, but strengthened. We are in such a situation today, and perhaps we are a little more worried than we ever were before, because the gradual tendency in the last several centuries has been toward world involvement in crisis. Up to a comparatively recent time, critical situations were more or less isolated. One group, one structure might come into emergency. But the rest of the world went along. Now, however, the emergency is one emergency. One critical situation threatens us, and out of it must come the only solution, as we well realize and have realized for years, namely world solution. The rapid increase in communication, transportation, the wide-flung diffusion of knowledge have altogether brought this world into a very close pattern. And it is no longer possible for one part to be involved in a struggle for existence, and the other parts remain tranquil observers of the situation. Today, we stand in great need for re-evaluating most of the patterns and practices with which we are now involved. There are very few persons who, deep in their own hearts, do not realize
that we are in the midst of trouble we have caused for ourselves. And, most disquieting, we do not seem to easily learn the lesson. Rather, we seem to prefer to go on, hazarding not only our own lives, but the future of our world, rather than to face the challenge and responsibility of our time. It therefore becomes no longer a problem of the individual depending upon leadership for the preservation of his society. More and more we realize the inadequacy of leadership. Leadership, to be completely successful, must be absolute. The leader must have despotic power. He may be a benevolent despot, but unless he has the authority, he cannot rule, and he cannot govern any longer without the sanction of the governed. This sanction is no longer available to leadership. And in our generation, the hyper-development of individualism is resulting in the collapse of the theory of leadership. We become more and more critical of leaders. And as the problems extend themselves into greater areas, we become convinced that leaders are unable to solve these problems. That the leader has not yet appeared who has the understanding and wisdom to lead the whole world to security. And even if he did arise, there is very little probability that the whole world could agree upon his virtue or his policy. We are therefore checkmated in the traditional way in which we used to live. We are no longer able to blame the leader. We still try to. But at the same time, we begin to recognize that authority is becoming more and more limited. What authority we have had has been largely abused. But at the same time, the constant limitation of authority means that we can no longer depend upon strong minds to lead weak minds. We discover that the strong minds are not strong enough really to lead, and the weak minds are not weak enough to follow. And we have a sort of impasse. And out of this impasse comes a tremendous amount of individualism, also resentment, pressure, and, as we observe it in private life, frustration. Actually, nature is trying to tell us something. It is trying to point out to us that authority is like parental guidance. Children growing up in a well-managed home accept parental leadership up to a certain time in life. Then the child must become an individual. If it fails to do so, it disgraces itself and also adds a tremendous burden to the responsibility of parenthood. The parent is not supposed to continue to administer the life of an adult. We are in the same situation. Mankind, in one way or another, is growing up. And as the child grows, it resents more and more parental authority. Yet unless this child is also equipped to accept the responsibilities of maturity, it may well have a disastrous career. This is the situation collectively which we are approaching very rapidly. So the natural answer must be, where are we going to find the directives necessary to take the place of despotic authority? And this brings us directly to our principal subject this evening, namely, the religious problem. If we go back over the history of religion, we will realize that down through the ages, it has exercised almost complete dictatorial authority over its followers. This is true of one religion as of another. The priests of religion were regarded as peculiarly venerable persons. And for both secular and sacred reasons, their authority was unquestioned. They had the right to determine not only the beliefs of men, but very largely the patterns of human conduct. Most religions include a revealed code of laws. These laws became the absolute statutes for those who belonged to the religion or accepted it. Even today, in most Orthodox religious groups of the world, the member is still under the control of what we might term dogma. And dogma is very largely traditional authority. It is an absolute dictatorship administered by an earthly priesthood. But it is assumed that this dogma is inevitable and infallible because it arises in the consciousness of God. Therefore, against it, there can be no reservation or revolution. Many religions have already vanished from the world, and others are in various states of decrepitude and decay. Others are still comparatively vital. But all religion up to the present time, or most religion up to the present time, has been established upon a foundation of authority. It was an authoritarian partner of the state down through the centuries. That which the religious body declared to be lawful, it was the duty of the state to enforce. It was also the duty of the state to protect the religion and to make certain that no foreign faith or foreign influence should adulterate the religion of that particular people or state. In the last 100 years, religious authority has also begun to dwindle. More and more, the power of religion over the destiny of people has changed from a factual, literal, temporal power to a psychological, theological, persuasive influence. The breakdown began in the Western civilization with the Reformation. And from that time on, we have had rising sectarianism within the structure of Christianity. Other religions which have influenced Western thinking have also felt numerous reforms. Until today, a large part of religion, especially its dogmatic part, is held to be legislative. Groups can get together and say, we will no longer accept this. They will then form a creed upon their own objection. And upon this, they will create a new reformed system. Thus, the ancient authority of the priest as the peculiar messenger of the Most High, as one anointed, as one set aside and apart, receiving to himself the apostolic succession. This type of attitude is dwindling. And while it is still held in some areas, its authority even in these areas is substantially weakening. And where religion is reactionary and refuses to accept the challenge of rising human individuality, the strength of the religion is undermined by an allegiance from members who do not actually conform. Thus, we have a breakdown within the structure in which we still have the follower, but he is following only in part and is following only according to his own mental, spiritual, or emotional reservations.
Now, it is obvious that with this situation, religion is also essentially and structurally weakened. It no longer has the power of leadership. It can no longer loose and unloose. It can no longer declare the way of states. It cannot control legislation. It cannot control education. It cannot control industry. It therefore has a moderate or nominal influence. And even where the sect is still extreme, its influence is less extreme because it cannot hold the full allegiance of its followers or members to these extreme positions. Out of all of this has come a point of view which has gradually led many people to feel that religion is, in a measure at least, private business. That religion is no longer of the power of a faith to dictate the destiny of its millions or hundreds of millions of followers. Today, faith is more or less a moral influence, a guide, a source of certain psychological strength, something that we are better with than without. But it is not a dynamic. So where we lose the power of the state to dictate the laws of men, and the power of religion to direct and control and even chastise the souls of men, we lose another bracket of leadership, and we find the individual drifting further and further toward a complete humanism. But man, by nature, has to admire something. He has to have a strong belief in something. And in the 19th century came the beginning of a new structure of belief. And this structure of belief was a certain scientific legislative biology. Out of this problem came, through such leaders as Darwin and Huxley, the beginning of our concept that man's final ruler was natural law. That if you wish to call this natural law God, well and good. If, however, you wish to consider this law merely an automatic process existing in space, this was also well and good. You no longer had the problem of good and evil. You had merely the problem of salvation or destruction. You no longer had man moved or persuaded by some rich emotional experience. You had him led by a certain type of common sense, an intellectual leadership, by which he was presumed to recognize that only by certain types of conduct could he preserve his civilization. Conduct then became a matter of science, because it called upon the individual to recognize the relationship of cause and effect in conduct, and that this law of cause and effect was merely an aspect, we will say, of the great evolutionary process taking place in nature. So we had what is referred to in the earliest documents of our own nation, nature and nature's God. And this concept of nature's God brought us very close to a new kind of scientific pantheism. And this, to a measure, still prevails among many of our intellectual groups. The next step beyond this was, of course, the gradual aggrandizing of the scientific position. The scientists began to take over the attributes of the divinely appointed king and the heavenly blessed priest. The scientist became, to a measure, the concept of the new savior or preserver of mankind. Now, this preservation was largely to be interpreted in terms of man's present existence. Science was to bring heaven to earth for man, to turn his mind and his eyes from any invisible universe beyond the mortal ken, and focus these eyes directly upon the possibility of building here in this world the noblest monument to progress that humanity had ever seen. Thus, progress became the new universal concept of the divine will. Science became the new instrument of absolute knowledge. And in this emancipated world of things, the scientist was a little lost at first because he really had not expected to inherit either a crown or a tiara. He had been more inclined to suspect that he might inherit the Inquisition or something of that nature, as he had done on previous occasions when he had been what Lord Bacon calls a birth out of time. That is, before the world was ready for him. Now we find that between about 1925 and 1960, the great religion of science, gaining more and more authority in our internal lives. Now, this was not necessarily authority demanded. It was authority freely bestowed. And to understand just how freely it has been bestowed, we must consider the story of our young people. Young people today are rising up in an economic industrial system in which science is the principal directing force. The great careers of today are in science. We are warned constantly that in education, our young people are not receiving enough science so that they can compete successfully with the rising scientific power of communism, for example. The race is now toward the development of the super scientist, the individual whose life is completely immersed in the wonders of the scientific universe. Now, it's not difficult to be captured in this pattern. We only have to observe the extraordinary advancements in many fields of specialization to realize how easily even a reasonably well-integrated human being could become enraptured, could develop a strong emotional sense, could have loyalty and patriotism and devotion and dedication to this thing which we call science. It seemed as though it was going to answer all the questions. It seemed as though it was going to give us what we had so long hoped for, and that is physical security. At the same time, it enabled us to free our minds from certain unfavorable aspects of previous leadership. We could begin to say to ourselves that we are not only free from the despotism of hereditary princes, we are also now free from the dogmatic despotism of theology. We no longer find ourselves limited and restrained intellectually. There is no longer a penalty upon thinking. The individual not only considered himself as addicted to a new and wonderful world, but in many, many ways he compared this new world with the old and found the new world better. This was especially easy, of course, with younger generations who had no memory, actually, of the better things of older times and could only read the atrocities recorded in history. Now, in the midst of this wonderful reintegration around the new concept of value, the scientific world has fallen apart. This was bad. When we say it has fallen apart, we don't mean that it is at the end of its career or that it can no longer contribute any good to mankind. but as a great image. A great image of man's hope. As the mysterious figure of the great God of the future. Science has lost stature very rapidly. And today we are confronted with the extremely obvious situation that science is now one of the principal dangers to security and to the survival of our way of life. The good that science can do, we applaud. The mistakes it makes, we begin to see. And the moment we begin to see mistakes, it is like finding feet of clay on our God. This tremendous devotion, this complete and soul rapture with which young people have turned to science. This is breaking down because science is actually failing these young people in the problem of their own survival. It is giving them a career, but not a life. It is giving them a job, but not a purpose. It is giving them a certain amount of comfort, but they are compensated or penalized by being in the midst of the worst insecurity the world has ever known. Now, this leaves us in a rather dilapidated situation. One kind of God after another has failed us. It isn't really ever, it has never been a God that failed us. It was our concept of that which was important that failed us. We gave far too much power and authority to the Roman Caesars. And Rome paid for this by the loss of the Roman Empire. We gave very much too much devotion and allegiance to the medieval popes. And as a result of that, we had the Reformation and the gradual loss of the prestige of theology. We gave too much exaggerated allegiance to science. And now again, we discover that our exaggerations have gotten us into difficulty. So we look around us again and we try to figure out the best we can what kind of a world we live in. More than this, where are we going to turn for directives? Our politicians are not getting any better. Our theologians are not getting any wiser. Our scientists are not getting any more ethical. And our businessmen are not getting much out of anything except money and taxes. This gets to be rather frustrating. That this tremendous struggle, this vast effort that we have made down through the ages seems now as though it is to bear little fruit and that it truly is turning into a withered vine just about the time when it should bear its noblest fruit. The individual has other ways to look, of course, and one way we have had a tendency to look in recent years has been to look over the fence and see how some other people lived. This has led to a term which we call interreligious understanding. We are beginning to suspect that perhaps somebody is better off than we are. We also are being able to enjoy the fact that other people suspect that we are better off than they are. And as a result, everybody is now looking into everybody else's backyard in the hope of discovering that distant pastures are greener. This is a good step. For the first time, we are beginning to face up to the fact that all the world has the same problem, and that if we would unite our resources, perhaps we could advance something a little nearer to solution. That somewhere lurking among the beliefs of mankind, there might be a good one. One better than we have suspected. Or perhaps, out of several weak ones, we can mold one stronger one, in which the weaknesses of one are counteracted by strong points in the structure of another. It looks, therefore, very much to many people that the only answer to religion at the moment is to try to find out where it is being well practiced and where it is producing constructive results, and examine in that direction. This, however, can lead rapidly to another mistake, because in our immediate haste, which is the keynote of the moment, we are quite likely to reach desperately toward some other faith. When we do this, we lose perspective again. We become too inclined, perhaps, to criticize everything in our own and accept without reservation everything in someone else's simply because it is strange and different, or because it has not the peculiar weaknesses or difficulties with which we are most familiar. Out of all of the hoping and struggling that we have done, there is slowly shifted to the top of things perhaps the most neglected area of thought the world has ever known, and that is philosophy. Up to 5 years ago, philosophy was considered to be little better than a nasty word. People of good breeding did not use it. It was better to be caught swearing than using the word philosophy. We were told that if it was put on the title of a book, it would not sell. We were told that if it was mentioned in mixed company, it would result in a deadly silence. We were also warned that it suggested mental hardship, that philosophy suggested thinking, and never in history has thinking been generally popular, and in this generation, less popular than ever before. This is why we're in the problem. Either thinking must become more popular, or we will be in a worse problem. So, in looking around among other nations, we discovered something that was rather strange to our own religious experience, namely that in many parts of the world, religion is a philosophy rather than a faith. This does not necessarily mean that other religions were lacking in faith, but that a good many religious beliefs were actually founded upon thinking. And contrary to our rather Western way of doing it, thinking was not a detriment to orthodoxy. In the Western world, when you started to think, your religious friends began to shake their heads. You were in trouble. And also, if you asked too many questions, you would ruin almost any system of theology. But in other parts of the world, religion asked questions and invited its followers to ask questions. And we found here and there, scattered around among some reasonably respectable peoples, religions that were actually based upon asking questions. That the individual was expected to inquire, expected to study, and that in order to be a good member of a religion, you had to spend 8 or 10 years actually learning what it was. This looked very different from anything that we knew about. Because, as Voltaire used to say, we solved the whole problem with a dash of cold water on the occiput. In other words, if the individual is baptized, he's saved. Now, we found that some of our neighbors on one side of the world or the other believed that salvation required not only water, but a little good soap with it. And this was quite a shock to us. So you can't blame a number of people for turning rather enthusiastically toward religious philosophies that not only ask questions, but are not afraid to answer them. And we began to develop what most of our more conservative friends would regard as a most suspicious tendency to heterodoxy, or perhaps even to heresy. But it felt rather good being a heretic, and so folks kept right on meditating according to yoga, or sitting quietly and disciplining their minds by Zen, or attending small groups of Vedantic students, and we're no longer surprised that some of the Eastern religions sent missionaries over here to save us. Of course, we had been so long engaged in saving them that we didn't get around to realizing that we were in poor shape ourselves. But out of the contact that we had with religions, primarily, outside of our own, I think our main reaction was the discovery of religious philosophy. We began to think of religion more as a series of answers to pressing questions, especially questions relating to conscience and conduct. That religions and philosophies demanded something of the individual beside his economic support. That these faiths demanded the example of his character in action. And it dawned upon us that many religious people in the world firmly believe that religion is a way of life according to character and conduct. Well, this came home to us as a bit of a surprise, but it led many people to the re-evaluation of the place of philosophy in knowledge. 10 years ago, psychology was very proud of the fact that it had escaped the boundaries of philosophy, that a psychologist was now a free soul in a branch of learning which he was creating and dignifying in his own way. In the last 5 years, more and more psychological journals and technical papers in the field are taking the attitude that the psychologist is proud of the fact that psychology is part of philosophy. This is indeed a new point of view. But after all, psychology can help you part of the time, but without philosophy, you're in trouble most of the time. So the understanding of philosophy became more or less necessary. So with great enthusiasm, we suddenly remembered that we had a number of philosophers in the West who had been resting quietly in cultural limbo for the last 500 years. When we got out of the Dark Ages, we also got out of philosophy. And with the exception of a few illustrious names, which we could quote but never read, we didn't know too much about philosophy in the West. So we began looking into the various contributions of unusual people, ranging over perhaps 2,500 years of Western culture. Plato broke into the daily newspaper. Aristotle became a subject for Rotarian discussion. And things that had not happened for a long time suddenly started happening in our modern world. But here we were in a real trouble, perhaps in a worse trouble we'd ever been in along the way at all, because now we had probably 500 philosophers to choose from. Most of them did not agree with each other. And many of them were in open conflict with each other. And most of these different schools had only a few surviving representatives, and these in turn were rather, shall we say, abstract personalities wandering around college campuses in a daze. We didn't have very much in the form of an integrated pattern of what philosophy means. We had come to the conclusion that it was merely a basis for intellectual argument, that it was a sharpening of the mind and the wits, but that it had nothing to do with the way you lived. And for years, philosophy was studied but never applied to the daily problem of the individual. It was refreshing, therefore, to find that some of the earlier philosophers, especially, did make definite applications. And men belonging to such schools as the Platonic and the Neoplatonic and the Neopythagorean were persons who lived what they believed. And this was what we were beginning to suspect was necessary. But philosophy did not offer us very much of an immediate hope or help. It was something we would have to come to sometime, but the time was really not yet. the emergency was such that we could not solve it completely by philosophical means. That is, the average person did not have the instruments necessary to do this. So nature and nature's God, to quote again the Declaration of Independence, seemingly was precipitating us into a dilemma. We had come almost to the end of a series of mistaken policies. And the end that we were reaching was the end of personal impoverishment of character. We are still rather seriously worried about the ethical decline, which is now being noticed by even those with the greatest degree of scientific astigmatism. They still now begin to see that there is real trouble. No one at the moment seems to know what to do about it. But I think the answer that finally will have to come is that the real purpose behind the emergency is to gradually shift the responsibility for personal growth upon the person where it belongs. I doubt very much if we will ever again pass through great periods of religious dictatorship. I don't think we will have the type of religious experience we have had in the past. I don't believe the spiritual good of mankind will be trusted to individuals who must become the leaders and guides of the rest. We will undoubtedly continue to produce great religious people. There is no question about that. But these people will be respected but not worshipped. The time has come when the entire problem of man's spiritual life must be solved by the person. Now, he has available to him most of the instruments of solution. He has in the world today, with its rapidly increasing contact, an opportunity never before possible to avail himself of the best available knowledge, and also the opportunity to orient his point of view in the largest area of knowledge that man has ever possessed. 100 years ago, comparative religion simply meant comparing several Protestant Christian sects. Today, comparative religion means and really means the study of the 8 or 10 religions of the world, which may be properly examined by any thoughtful person, and no legislation can prevent it. We have, therefore, as never previously available, all of the general information necessary to orient ourselves in our own religious life. You all remember dear old Dr. Eliot's 5-foot bookshelf. Dr. Eliot was convinced that by taking his 5-foot bookshelf and were studying on it for a half an hour a day, you could, in from 3 to 5 years, attain an almost universal education. You would be equipped for almost any ordinary problem that confronts an educated person. Now, this was not a particularly heavy program when we realize that most of us waste more time than that every day. But it is true that what we need to know in order to clarify our own mind is available to us if we want to use it. Now we look around us as De Quincey looked around the British Museum, and then we weep as he did because we can't live long enough to read all the books. This is not necessary. We are now in possession of major works, selective works, which we can read. And most of what we need to know is available to us during the years of our mature life. And from what we are able to learn, we can arrive at very strong inner reactions, which we can direct in almost any way that seems best to our own understanding. So out of all of this long path of things, and the confusion and the chaos and the crises that have gone before. We stand for the first time, perhaps, in the actual presence of the possibility of a religious life based not upon dogma or birth or conversion, but based upon the fact that the human being is by nature religious, and that therefore he has a spiritual potential within himself by which he can live a proper life under the leadership of a consciousness aware of the basic needs of the human personality. So we now have the problem of putting together a personal religious life. And all that has gone before has led in this direction. But like lazy children, we did not want to learn in order that we could ultimately labor. We wanted to learn in order that we might, in the end, come only to leisure. This is not nature's way, and nature will never support us in this procedure. So we now stand on the threshold of a universe of experience and of consciousness which we have to live in. Each moment, we are stepping into tomorrow. And each one of us will have to face some tomorrows, some more, some less, but we will all have to face them. And we will have to face them with increasing interior insight. For if we are unable to do this, the problem of the future will become heavier and heavier, and we will become more and more discouraged and even destroyed by the pressure of external circumstances. Out of this situation, philosophy, science, religion, education, all of these instruments together must provide us with the raw materials of a greater faith. Each one of these institutions and structures that we have built up must show us both their strength and their weakness. Their strength will help us. Their weakness we must avoid. If they have gone to excess, we must seek for moderation. If they have ignored vast areas of essential knowledge, we must cultivate these areas in ourselves. It is our duty to live a balanced life and make balanced use of the unbalanced forces that surround us. If we do not do this, we cannot build our own spiritual conviction. The most dynamic group, probably, working in the world today is one of the smallest, and that is the atheist. The atheist is not a new production. We like to think of him as peculiar to our own century, but this is not true. There were atheists in ancient India, and there were atheists in Greece. There were a great many atheists in Rome, and I'm afraid there have been a great many atheists in religion, although they didn't actually come out and proclaim themselves as such. Today, atheism is now linked with a political point of view, and it has gradually gained a small but intense following. Atheism has the same peculiar type of tactic which has distinguished communism for a long time. The communist may be a comparative minority, but he is a dynamic minority. He is a minority that relentlessly and continually presses its own purpose. Our intellectual atheist is in approximately the same type of mind. And we know that most of the personalities in communism are self-proclaimed atheists. Now, it's a hard thing exactly to understand how it happens that atheists are willing to become merchants of death. You would think that an atheist who has no place to go when he leaves here would want to stay here as long as possible. You would think also that he would be the last type of individual who would want to die for a forlorn cause. You would not think also that he would want to blow up his own civilization or his own culture. Because if he has no place to go, and there is nothing in front of him but oblivion, Something very strange must have happened to him. He must be a terribly unhappy person, or he would not be willing to accept what might be little more than a suicidal complex. We cannot quite justify the atheist in his gradual intensification of a scientific industrial program which is fatal to himself. If he could believe honestly that he could die for his cause and then go into some paradisical sphere like the followers of Hassan Sabah, it might be nice to die for a leader if from then on you lived in paradise. But what is the peculiar advantage of dying for a leader if here and on you don't live anywhere? That the entire subject is one of absolute negation. What particular value is there in anything winning anything if, as it says in Hamlet, the rest is silence? Just what does atheism do? It not only cuts off man's hope of a future existence, but by its present policies cuts short his present existence and threatens the total annihilation of his way of life. Just where is the gain? Where is the objective? Where is the purpose? We may say that it is social progress, but atheistic science is threatening the survival of social progress. So very little remains. Your atheistic minority, therefore, represents a completely defeated group of some kind, a group which has accepted internal defeat, that has lost sight of all real motives or all real purposes, and is deficient in all positive convictions. Agnosticism we can understand. It can well be the belief of an honest doubter. But atheism is not agnosticism, nor is it an honest doubt. It is a forthright unbelief, a complete disbelieving. And for what end? For what purpose? For what good? For what conceivable result that can have any significance to man, nature, or the universe? This is an imponderable. But we notice, little by little, how this situation is encroaching, just as certain communistic concepts continue to encroach and infiltrate. For instance, in a paper not long ago, I noticed an article that represented an expression about the future of labor in this country. It was apparently a completely harmless statement to the effect that in a very short time, man would be able to reduce his problem of labor so that he could work for 9 days and then rest for 5, thus creating a new concept of leisure. But in a mysterious way, the concept of the Sabbath was lost right there, and no one even noticed it. There was no longer going to be any Sunday, as there is no longer any Sunday behind the Iron Curtain. Well, a Sunday is not so important, but it is a symbol of something. It is a symbol of another encroachment upon an ancient pattern of belief, a gradual weaning of the mind away, little by little, from every religious anchorage. Now, there can well be, even among communistic people, a sad story of what religion did to them and the difficulties they faced and the hardships they went through because of the cruelty of both church and state. But this does not justify the destruction of a basic idea merely because that idea has been perverted. We are still not in any condition to live without some conviction beyond the belief in our own superlative genius. With this type of believing, we are heading into, I won't say limbo, because limbo was a comparatively painless place. We are going to head into something infinitely more uncomfortable. So we come to the final situation, that all of this conspiracy and much more that we can't possibly summarize in the time that we have is bringing everything back as a responsibility to the person. We are now living in a universe large enough in our own comprehension to enable us to think through for ourselves
the essential values that we regard as important. And we have also reached a point where these values cannot be dogmatic, that they are not something thrust upon us, something held over our head with a whip in the other hand. They are now our own needs reaching out for the answer that will save us. So we really are becoming, perhaps, less theological, but essentially we have a greater capacity to be religious than ever before, because we are beginning to approach religion in its highest form, and that is the direct communion between man and his own ideals, the principles and the truths which he holds to be most certainly true and necessary to himself. So how are we going to build a universal concept now? I think we stand, most of all, at a dividing point between the belief in God and no belief at all. Science has very largely tried to destroy the God concept in the universe, but it has not succeeded in doing so. For principally and factually, the more we discover about the universe, the greater our original question becomes.